This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Did President Biden's spending plans just get some help from the Senate parliamentarian? Meanwhile, a few of his allies are pushing back on the filibuster, taxes, and packing the Supreme Court. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. The Senate parliamentarian, normally not a high-profile job, is back in the news again. Remember earlier this year, the question was whether a $15 minimum wage counts as a budget item, meaning it could pass in a budget reconciliation package with only 50 votes. And the answer then was a definite no, which upset Bernie Sanders and other progressive members of the Democratic Party. But on Monday, the parliamentarian issued a new opinion that many reporters, Kim, are saying will give President Biden more leeway on his next $3 or $4 trillion spending plans. So what's the story here, and is that an accurate assessment?
So the story here is that we have something called the 1974 Budget Act. And what it does is it allows Congress once every fiscal year to pass a budget resolution for federal revenue and outlays. And this is where we get the process known as reconciliation, which, of course, has become very valuable to both parties because it's a way of going around the filibuster. The problem that Democrats have been trying to get around or come up with a clever solution for is how could you potentially use it more than one time every fiscal year? Because they've already used it once. They used last year's fiscal year for the CARES Act that was recently just passed, the big COVID relief bill. And that means they have one more this year, but they wanted to do even more. So they went and they dug through the law, and there's a thing called Section 304. And basically what the language says is that it allows the Senate to revise or reaffirm the pending resolution. And they made the argument to the Senate parliamentarian that this meant that they ought to be able to essentially go back and do revisions to the existing resolution, potentially infinite numbers of revisions. And apparently the parliamentarian has ruled, and Chuck Schumer's office immediately spread it far and wide that she had given them the green light. But I have spoken to a number of Republicans who say that is he's way out in front of his skis, that in effect, what they understand is that what she has ruled is that, yes, the language of the Budget Act allows you to revise or reaffirm a pending reconciliation bill or one that's already passed. But it's not really clear what the parameters of that are. For instance, you know, are you only allowed to revise provisions that were already in that first bill? Are you allowed to actually introduce new things? And so I don't think we really have an answer on this yet, but we do have Chuck Schumer pressing very hard to make hay out of this and the process get the parliamentarian to go along with all their desires.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting analysis, Kim, because that's definitely not the way that this is being discussed in the news articles, the headlines that are talking about this. I mean, essentially what they're saying is, what they're suggesting is that the parliamentarian may allow the Democrats in the Senate to essentially reuse that budget vehicle, maybe once, maybe more than once. And the idea then, Bill, as I understand it, is then instead of trying to pass, you know, one massive $2 trillion infrastructure bill, and then you've used that reconciliation shot, President Biden and Chuck Schumer could chop that up into smaller pieces that might go down more easily. And I guess I don't know, you still are trying to pass the same thing. So I guess I don't know how the politics on that works, but it seems that at least is the theory, Bill.
Yes, as you point out, what we have now mostly in the press is Senator Schumer's interpretation of what the parliamentarian has decided. And she decided very narrowly, very generally. And there's so many other questions. And again, all we're getting is the Senator Schumer side. I'd like to hear the Senator McConnell side, because you can bet with all these things, even if they go down reconciliation, there are other rules about what's germane, what's not, and so forth. And you can bet Senator McConnell knows them, and he could slow things down if he wants to. Your point, I think, is also right, that instead of, you know, stuffing it all into some one massive bill, the language of 304 doesn't specifically rule out doing this any number of times. You know, the way it's done now, it's generally limited to, you know, two a year. But if this is allowed to stand the way Senator Schumer thinks, it allows you to do sort of as many as you want. And then you kind of, you don't have these whopping price tags that might get as much attention and all the details. It allows them to spread out the pain and the political pain. But whatever this is, what it's really about is that the Democrats in a tied Senate with the vice president casting the deciding vote have no margin for error. And what they're trying to do is pass massive bills, big, big spending bills. I mean, trillion seems to be the favorite word used in the president's proposals, without having to have any Republican votes. And I think this is bad on its own, but it's certainly a betrayal of Joe Biden's campaign promise. Remember, he was the guy that was going to take us back to normal and work with Republicans, that he had a long record of working with Republicans. And now he's doing the exact opposite. And what's astounding to me is very few people are calling him out on that.
I mean, a couple other hangups I would bring up, the first of which is, I mean, even if you assume that Schumer's interpretation of this parliamentarian opinion is correct, Bill brings up the rules on germaneness, the Byrd rule. It still leaves that in place. So one thing this would not change, Kim, is you still have to make an argument that what you want to put in that reconciliation bill, even if you get to use it two or three times, has to be germane to reconciliation. So you still can't get in the 15 minimum wage or a whole host of other things that are on the Democratic agenda here.
Yeah, much of the proposal that they are, in fact, putting out there. One of the reasons that the CARES Act largely worked under reconciliation, except for things, as you mentioned, like the minimum wage, is because it was a bill almost primarily designed to just hand money to everybody. And that is the traditional definition of a budget bill, dealing, as it were, with federal outlays or federal revenues, which is another way of saying spending or taxation. But a lot of this proposal, because remember, so much of it is focused on clean energy, for instance, and labor provisions. These have to do with policies. So, for instance, a proposal calls for passing the PRO Act, which is a pro-union piece of legislation, and it includes things like card check provisions for union organizing and strike provisions, and the ability of the National Labor Relations Board to be more punitive against companies that do not sit back and let unions do whatever they want. Those are all, by definition, straight up policy changes. They don't have anything to do with spending. They don't have anything to do with taxation. Another example, one of the provisions of the proposal would call for utilities to only use clean energy sources by 2035. Not anything to do with spending or taxation. This is a policy change. Earmarks is another one that Democrats want to bring them back. Not likely that it would pass under the Byrd rule. One more thing that I would point out that could be a real problem, even though you have Chuck Schumer saying the parliamentarians said yes to this, we haven't heard whether or not Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema have said yes to this. And, you know, both of them have been very adamant that they want the spirit of the filibuster, not just the filibuster to exist, but the spirit of the filibuster to remain in place. This is undoubtedly a clear maneuver to go around the filibuster. And you can imagine that there will be some real pressure on them to say no to this, much as they said no to overruling the parliamentarian on the Byrd rule.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. We'll return to Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin here in a minute, but one last thought on this reconciliation maneuver by Chuck Schumer here, Bill, is that it seems to me that if this is successful, something that senators need to keep in mind is that it's going to be successful on both sides. If the Democrats here are successful in reusing this reconciliation vehicle, passing another bill with only 50 votes through this sort of reinterpretation of the budget rules, you can bet, I think, Bill, that Republicans, when they retake the chamber, will be eager to do the same with their own priorities.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the tragedies of this. First of all, the incentive for the minority, when the minority gets stiffed, not just that they lose, but they really get stiffed. And in this case, it's sort of going around the rules or changing the rules. You just build up a seething resentment. And this is a bad way for politics to work. You know, whatever we think about the individual merits of the filibuster and the rules on reconciliation and so forth, I mean, it would seem to me if Senator Schumer gets away with what he's trying to do, all those rules are effectively neutered, right? And what it means is you just ram things through with one side in a incredibly narrow Senate. You can't get more narrow than it is now, 50-50. I think whatever else the founders intended, that's not what they intended. The Senate was designed to have different rules and procedures to facilitate thoughtful thinking about something, not just being overcome with the passions of the day, and to make compromises with the other side. If this is allowed to stand, you take that incentive out, and both sides will take advantage of that. And I think also our politics will become even more embittered than it is today. And again, this goes back. This is from the man who promised that he would bring about healing and unity and reach out to the other side, and he's doing the exact opposite.
But if this is successful, does it also take some pressure off of Manchin and Sinema to eventually fully break the filibuster? I mean, it's notable, I think, that Sinema recently was speaking to a Journal reporter and stood up for the filibuster. Here's what she said. When you have a place that's broken and not working, and many would say that's the Senate today, I don't think the solution is to erode the rules. I think the solution is for senators to change their behavior and begin to work together, which is what the country wants us to do. So, Kim, I mean, how do you read that defense of the filibuster from her in this context?
It's interesting that she did it, because one thing that's kind of fascinating about Kyrsten Sinema, and I actually admire her for it, is whereas Joe Manchin is out there in front of every television camera every moment of the day, you know, you can call that just being visible, and maybe that's a good thing for senators to do, but it does put him in these tough positions at times where, you know, he kind of is getting hounded constantly for his latest thinking on everything. Sinema just doesn't talk to the press a lot. She's more of a quiet senator. But when she does tend to make news. And it was notable. This is one of the first times she's spoken at any length about the filibuster. I agree with her point, which is that the Senate is not broken. The rules are not broken. The people are broken. And the answer to that is, you know, it seemed to be in some ways a bit of an implicit criticism of both sides, including her party, noting that if you're going to put forward really radical proposals, you're probably not going to get much buy-in from the other side. I was also kind of interested to see that she was asked about changes to the filibuster. Mr. Manchin obviously got out front and said he'd be open to changes like bringing back the talking filibuster. And in that Journal interview, she said she didn't even want to talk about hypotheticals such as bringing back the talking filibuster. And it sounds as though she just really wants the chamber to figure out a way to go forward on a bipartisan basis.
Well, that's interesting, because I also highlighted that section where she said she didn't want to talk about hypotheticals. But I guess I read that, Bill, as leaving herself a little bit of wiggle room in case 49 of her colleagues are pounding on her door saying, we want to do the talking filibuster.
Yeah, that could well be. But in general, I think that's a good practice. I think it's generally a mistake for politicians to come out definitively on a hypothetical, right? I mean, what do they gain from that? Usually then everything else that comes after is designed to take them off that or move them or embarrass them. So I think she has the smarter strategy there. And again, Kim is sort of comparing with Joe Manchin. I mean, one of the frustrations with Joe Manchin is he's like, he's not going to allow the filibuster to be taken away under any circumstances. Then he's open to some modifications. You never know exactly if the line that Joe Manchin draws is a line or just a statement followed by the fuzzing of that line later on down the road. So I agree with Kim. I think Senator Sinema has a wiser strategy.
Well, speaking of Joe Manchin drawing lines, he did another one here on Biden's tax plans. And here's what he told a local West Virginia radio station. He said, "The bill basically is not going to end up that way. If I don't vote to get on it, it's not going anywhere. So we're going to have some leverage here. And it's more than just me," unquote. And then he cited one specific provision, Kim. Biden wants to raise the corporate tax rate to 21%, from 21% to 28%. And Kim, Manchin thinks that's too high.
Yeah, you know, I have to be honest that I've kind of quickly gotten over being on the Manchin watch for what Manchin says on any given day, because I remember all the way back at the beginning of this year, oh so long ago, when people were talking about the whoppingly huge $1.9 trillion CARES Act, he was tweeting around, numbers about the size of the debt and saying that, you know, he wasn't going to go that high. And in the end, he did. So, you know, here he is. Okay, so not 28%, and he says maybe 25%. First of all, I would note that, you know, I guess that's better than 28%, but what does it really mean at the end of the day? Is he really going to stick to that? Maybe. Or even if he does stick to it, and other things as he's threatening to do, history suggests that what it took to get Joe Manchin to come along on the prior bill was not much. He won a few very slight concessions and then basically just, you know, said yes to everything else in the bill. So, you know, is this just his cover? Oh, look, I stood up for a slightly lower corporate rate, but I'm now gives me free rein to vote yes on the rest of $2.3 trillion worth of awfulness. I guess we'll just have to see where that goes.
Yeah, I had a similar sort of cynical reaction to this. I mean, he's saying that 28% is too high, but he's okay with 25%. So, I mean, is that 3% difference the decider between whether America is competitive or uncompetitive for business across the globe? Or, Bill, I mean, do you agree here that he's kind of splitting the difference and getting a moderate label out of it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he's doing. I mean, as Kim points out, there's just too many incidences where Joe Manchin draws a line, and then 2 days later, you wake up to find, well, the line, it's really about percentage points, or it's about this, or I wouldn't go that far. The line doesn't really mean anything. He's willing to cross it as long, you know, whether it's minimum wage or these corporate tax rates and so forth. So the problem is for the Biden administration is that he can get away with it because they need every single vote, though the concentration has been on him because he comes from a more conservative state. In principle, any Democrat can, you know, hold the Biden administration's plans hostage by saying they're going to go vote against it. So Joe Manchin has been more expert at this, but I think like him, a lot of people are just getting tired of it because his words, his opposition, his principle don't seem to ever really pan out to mean what people thought they meant when he first said them.
But another issue for Biden here is the recovering economy. And Kim, does that make it harder all the time to justify the kind of spending that Biden wants? I mean, there's a journal editorial on Tuesday, and the headline is, "Sorry, the economic crisis is over."
Well, it is. You know, and we pointed out that, in fact, the bottom of the recession may have been as early as last April. And the economy has essentially been growing for at least 9 months. And we got the latest evidence of that. On Monday, the Institute for Supply Management put out its March survey for service businesses, and it hit 63.7. That's an all-time high. It signifies a lot of growth and optimism. And it follows last week's unbelievable employment report for March, which when you take into account revisions for the previous 2 months, we had a net total of more than a million new jobs. So I think the lesson here is that the vaccine is getting out there. People are returning to work. Businesses are reopening. States are reopening. If you stay out of its way, the economy is going to roar, continue to roar. And I think it's notable that the biggest problem we have right now is that a lot of businesses say they can't find enough workers. And that's in effect because the federal government did pass the CARES Act and continued to put out that federally enhanced unemployment insurance.
Right. And this is spilling into a lot of the news coverage. I mean, there's a Bloomberg story. The headline is prospective hires plied with $1,500 signing bonuses and pizzas. The subhead is, despite high unemployment, a record share of small businesses say they have jobs they can't fill. And so, Bill, this gets back to a previous conversation on a previous podcast about the great polling for that $1.9 trillion COVID spending package, and whether that polling will start to turn around as the economy does.
I don't know about the polling. People, you know, people may not turn against it. I think down the line, it might have an effect on other massive spending. But I think the larger point is what we've always been saying. The real stimulus for the economy is opening it up and letting people get back to their jobs. A lot of this stuff is at best marginal along the edges. And we see that the economy doesn't need all this government help and so forth and all this spending. People are going back to work, and that is what's growing the economy. And that's what the emphasis should be on. But again, government politicians, you know, of all parties, like to say we've done something, and because we acted, this is what's happening. That's why this is such an embarrassment for them. Leave businesses alone. Let them do their jobs. Let them hire people. Don't give people incentives not to work. And the economy will probably do just fine.
Finally, another opponent of ambitious plans, maybe one that will surprise some listeners, Justice Stephen Breyer, Supreme Court Justice, who is on the left side of the bench, often not on the winning side of cases these days, said in some remarks on Tuesday that he opposes plans to add justices to the Supreme Court. He said his remarks were intended to make, here's a quote, make those whose initial instincts may favor important structural or other institutional changes, such as forms of court packing, think long and hard before embodying those changes in law. Kim, that should carry some weight, I think.
Yeah. And you know what? I wasn't as surprised by this because Breyer, he's 82. He's the court's oldest justice. And, you know, I think very much falls into that mold of justices who truly believe in the institution of the Supreme Court and in the importance of keeping it out of politics. And obviously, you know, he's very passionate when he writes his opinions, and they certainly trend a certain way. But, you know, a lot of the justices, it's notable, once they get to the court, they kind of reject, they don't like talking about themselves as conservative or liberal justices. There's a great camaraderie on the court as well, too. And I thought it was great that he came out and did this. And just flat out basically warn the Democrats, don't mess with the court. It's not going to be good in the long run. It's bad for the country. And I think that if you were to talk to a number of the other justices, in particular, some of the conservative justices on the court, they'd probably make the same argument. It'd be nice to see some of the other ones come out and say it, too. It would probably be the best way of checking some of those Democratic proposals.
But, Bill, I wonder if that voice on the court is convincing to a guy like Joe Biden, an institutionalist we always are hearing. I don't know how convincing it is, though, to some other elements of the Democratic Party on the progressive side, because a lot of those people are the ones who are busy telling Justice Breyer that he's got to retire while there's still time.
Not only that, they've been talking about adding seats to the Supreme Court and so forth. Look, I think this is one of the sub fights that we're having below the surface over policy. We're having a fight of whether we value our institutions and are going to play by the rules to get what we want, rather than to get rid of anything in the way, whether it's the Senate, whether it's the number of states that we have on behalf of a partisan political goal. And I don't see the Democratic Party committed to that anymore. Now, I do think that if they do move ahead with some of this agenda, they will face consequences later, as you mentioned on the reconciliation. I mean, Republicans could do that as well. There's a lot of steps that could be taken. But again, none of this is healthy for the company, for the country. You know, the rule of law depends a bit on consistency and using regular procedure. And what we have in the few months since Joe Biden took office is all accepted procedure thrown out the window. Do whatever you have to get where you want to go and worry about the consequences later. That is not a prescription for unity or progress.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.